One word to describe the following people: Donald Trump.
Chaos.
Elizabeth Warren.
It's a reason why we have pensions.
AOC.
Great bartender.
Let's talk about Bernie Sanders for a second, because there's...
He doesn't talk to me anymore.
If Jeff Bezos were sitting here, what would you say to him?
Oh, I'd call him a piece of shit.
From the Free Press, this is Honestly, and I'm Barry Weiss. The question of who represents the working class is probably the hottest debate in American politics right now. Is it the Republicans? Is it the Democrats? Or is it socialists like Zora Mamdani? Pundits can debate that question all they want. But the undeniable test might be this. Who do unions believe stand for working people? For a century, unions in America were undeniably democratic. And in 2021, Biden tried to carry on that tradition. He went so far as to say, "I intend to be the most pro-union president, leading the most pro-union administration in American history." Then, in 2023, he became the first sitting president to walk a picket line, joining United Auto Workers in their strike against General Motors, Ford, and Stellantis. But as the Democratic Party moved left and then further left, many union members, people who had been reliable Democratic voters, broke the mold and voted Republican. In 2024, nearly half of union households voted for Donald Trump. So what was it? Was it Trump's hatred of NAFTA? Was it his promise to bring manufacturing back to America? Was it his character, however you define that? Was it the left's preoccupation with boutique issues? Or was it that these union members wanted to send a middle finger to the current American elite? That shift was most palpable, I think, when Teamsters president Sean O'Brien spoke at the 2024 Republican National Convention, despite being a lifelong Democrat. It felt like a new era. At the Free Press, we've reported extensively on how the Democratic Party lost the working class. But 6 months into Trump's second term, the question is, are working class Trump voters happy with their choice? And how has Trump been for labor in America? Sean O'Brien, the voice you heard at the RNC, is the president of the International Brotherhood of Teamsters, representing 1.3 million union workers. It's one of the biggest unions in the country. As Sean puts it, they represent airline pilots to zookeepers and everyone in between. That in between includes truck drivers, warehouse workers, mechanics, baggage handlers, construction workers, UPS drivers. UPS happens to be their largest employer. And basically, the Teamsters have organized workers in every occupation imaginable. It's not just that Sean is the Teamsters president. It's that he himself is a fourth-generation union member, having joined the Local 25 at 17 years old as a heavy equipment driver in Boston. He has spent more than 30 years in the union and has a unique vantage point from which he sees American organized labor. Today on Honestly, I ask Sean why he spoke at the RNC. Why he's still a Democrat? How Trump has been for labor, given his coziness with Elon Musk, Doge, and now his big, beautiful bill. I ask how Democrats can win union workers back, and if the unions can find their footing again. I ask how he plans to organize Amazon. You'll hear that he has some choice words for Jeff Bezos, among many others. And how to ensure that more American workers have access to what we used to call the American dream.
Sean O'Brien, welcome to Honestly.
Thank you very much. I love the title.
Very, very happy to have you here.
Doesn't seem that there's a lot of honesty in the world anymore.
Well, we try and do that here on this show.
I'm sure you do, but there's a pandemic out there with a lot of people called liabetes.
Oh my God, I've never heard that.
Yeah, they're making a vaccine for it right now. Hopefully they'll call it Truthsilin, where people can stop telling the truth and calling balls and strikes.
Well, I like having people on who I feel embody the title of the show, which is one of the reasons I'm so excited that you're here. And I want to start by just talking a little bit about how you grew up. You, your father, your grandfather, your great-grandfather immigrated from Ireland, all were members of Local 25 in Boston. What did the union mean to you and your family when you were growing up?
Oh, it was an icon. It was like, you know, growing up in Boston, you know, you always hear of the great sport teams like the Boston Celtics, Boston Bruins. Well, the Teamsters Union, in my eyes, and the way that we were brought up, was an icon. You know, the Teamsters Union was so prevalent And there were so many people, especially in the communities we grew up with, that were members of the Teamsters Union. So, I mean, for me personally, and I've said this recently at an event I was at, I'm like, this organization has been so important to me in my entire life. Like, I knew at 8 years old that I wanted to be a Teamster. I wanted to drive a truck. I wanted to be just like my father. And, you know, we would be sitting around in school and, you know, what do you want to do when you grow up? No, I want to be a doctor. I want to be a lawyer. I want to be a pro athlete. I was like, I want to drive a truck for the Teamsters Union. It meant everything to me. It still does. I mean, I love the organization, you know, and I never thought I'd be the general president, but I knew I wanted to run Local 25. And I was in the union prior to going to college. We worked in the theater district and the Boston Garden, load and unloading trucks.
You were a rigger.
I was a rigger by trade. Yeah, I did my apprenticeship program when I left school, and then I went right directly in full time.
Drop me into, you're 17 years old, you're 18 years old. What is the culture and sort of the political makeup of the Teamsters back then?
Well, the political makeup of the Teamsters back then is, so it's 1990 when I got in, but I was around it, you know, obviously working, say, 88 to 89. It was a pretty tough culture because the government was involved in our affairs at that point in time. There was our general president at the time was a guy named Billy McCarthy, who was the president of Teamsters Local 25, where I came out of. He signed my union card when I got in there. And the Teamsters were under a nationwide investigation where there was going to be an indictment nationwide of the Teamsters Union under the RICO Act because of organized crime. So McCarthy negotiated a deal to put us under a consent decree, which we're currently still under, which is government oversight. So back then, it was a lot different, the landscape. I mean, you still had some, you know, bad people in the organization. You had organized crime in the major cities. So it was very intense. And, you know, coming out of Boston, especially where we grew up, you know, we knew what it was all about. And seeing the transformation to where it was, you know, and you hear stories from the 50s, the 60s, the 70s, and 80s. But where we were back then when I first got into where we are now, leaps and bounds. I mean, our union's the cleanest union around. But going back then, it was tough. But, you know, I'll tell you, it was fun. I mean, back then, it was like playing football. Because you'd go on job sites when I was a steward, and you'd be arguing and fighting with pipe fitters and iron workers. But, you know, at the end of the day, everybody had a job to do. Now, today, it's like, if you're going to get in a fight with someone or an argument, you know, it's an attack on Facebook or Twitter or one of them, or it's a pillow fight, you know what I mean? And you get a lot of keyboard warriors out there that if they were actually had to get in a tense situation compared to what it is now versus 30 years ago, I think there'd be a lot, it would probably be a lot better because I'll tell you what, you know, back then.
Better to sock someone in the face.
Not even sock someone in the face, but the fear of knowing that there'd be a consequence for an action, right? Mm. Not so much a physical action, but, you know, back then you were brought up with a lot of respect. You came into a job and you watched how that job was done. You didn't give your opinion until you were asked for it. And that's how you learn. Now, anybody can say whatever they want, do whatever they want, whether it's true or not, or get on a social media platform. It's like people just want to say something negative no matter what it is. And no matter what you do, you could do 10 things great. And the one thing that, you know, you may not be able to control and doesn't have the outcome that someone wants, you're no good. And that's all people talk about. And it's like, come on, well, yeah, let's look back at what we did. And, you know, I went through something similar when I spoke at the RNC. You know, we come off negotiating a $30 billion deal, the UPS, largest contract ever, largest settlement, still the best contract ever, 340,000 members. And after I speak at the RNC, you know, I get completely attacked by the left, the DSA warriors that, you know, sit on a keyboard. They, you know, they think it's okay to burn flags in the middle of the street and everything else. And then you have people saying, well, UPS lost the Amazon account. The Teamsters did it. Why did we do it? Oh, the contract was too rich. No, Amazon has more money than most nations in the world. So no, that's not it. But it's just like everybody has something to say. And it used to bother me. It doesn't bother me anymore. It really doesn't, because I know that at the end of the day, you just stick to your core disciplines, your core values, and never forget who you work for. And, you know, we're going to be good. We're going to be great. I mean, we organized 80,000 members in 3 years. We're negotiating the strongest contracts. We struck Amazon. I mean, we could go on and on and on. And
I want to talk about Amazon.
All people
want to
focus on is he spoke at the RNC. Oh, shit. I was asked to speak there. I would have spoke at the DNC and gave the same speech.
Okay, well, I want to talk about that. One sort of broad question before we talk about that major decision, which is what put you on my radar and the radars of so many other Americans. Mm-hmm. There was this idea, I think about like my grandparents' generation, or even to a large extent my parents, that you could have a stable, comfortable middle-class life in this country with on a one-parent income. You could have, you know, the Chevy in the garage, the chicken on in the oven. Like this, there was this almost caricature of the American dream that was tenable for people.
And maybe a vacation.
Exactly.
Once a year, right?
Right. Now that feels like another, just literally, it feels like it could be the Middle Ages. It feels so far away. Mm-hmm. And you hear about, you know, I'm sure you have your anecdotes. I have mine of, you know, getting in an Uber and talking to the Uber driver and finding out that this is like their third job, or right, it's a public school teacher and they can't make ends meet, and so they have to drive Uber at night. When you think about just the seismic change to where it used to be possible to have one working parent and provide for your family, to now where you have two working parents and even those 9-to-5 jobs are not sufficient to support a family, how, like, who's the culprit? Like, who's to blame? Is it technology? Is it an attitude that we have toward labor? Who's to blame for the fact that you can't have that anymore?
Well, I think there's such a disparity between, you know, the haves and have-nots, right? You look at, you know, the cost of buying a home now compared to 35, 40 years ago, 50 years ago. You look at the cost of purchasing a vehicle. You look at the cost of tuition. I mean, it is so out of whack. Where people can't live on one income. And the other thing, too, is I think we've made it too easy in a society to put people in debt, right? When you don't have the cash, right, what do? You put on a credit card. And those credit cards are 19 to 29 to 30%, depending on your credit. So it's like a strategy, I think, just to keep people in debt now and, you know, make them beholden to working 2 or 3 jobs. Think about it. I mean, my father worked 2 jobs, right? My mother was not a stay-at-home mother. She worked, she hustled. But, you know, when you look at a family now, you look at 2 parents working probably 2 demanding jobs, just making ends meet because they paid so much more for their house. They pay so much more in taxes. They're paying so much more for vehicles. You can't go out and buy a vehicle for $3,500 anymore. You can buy a good used one, maybe for $45,000, which you're going to pay higher interest because you're in debt everywhere else. So I think it's just a combination of you know, people not embracing unionized workers where you can actually fight for better wages, better conditions. I think, too, because that had to do with a lot of deregulation in a lot of industries. 2, I just think there's such a disparity between executive pay versus everybody else. And I just think society is out of whack and needs a reset.
Okay, so you mentioned your speech at the RNC,
right,
and I want to get there by talking about what the Teamsters did in the 2024 election, which is that you gave each of the candidates a 16-question interview to answer. Tell me about this process.
So we felt it was important because, you know, we came in as a new leadership in 2022. We were sworn in. And I've been around the team since a long time. And the one thing that we learned during campaigning and then we learned in a previous election was that there was no inclusiveness of rank and file members in a lot of things we do or did back then. And there wasn't any type of transparency in the process. In other words, you know, the president of the Teamsters historically would say, we're going to endorse Joe Biden. Okay, well, what?
Why?
Why? And where's the data, information, or support why we should endorse him? So we said, you know, the one thing we did, and again, you learn everything from home, like your values in your neighborhood to your workplace. Well, I did the same. Like I knew when I was running Local 25, which was 12,500 members, that whenever we did something like an election on a statewide level, we would always poll our members that lived in those communities that were going to be affected by it. So we took that kind of discipline and policy and brought it to a federal level. And when we started to do this, you know, don't forget, a lot of the major unions jumped right in right away with Biden, Biden-Harris. And that was probably like December of 23. And we're like, no, we're not going to do that. We need to poll our members. Why are you going to poll your members? Well, those are the people that we're going to be telling to vote. And if we're going to tell someone to vote for a candidate, we want to make sure that's who they want to vote for. So we brought every single presidential candidate, which has never been done before, into our building. We gave them the 16 questions, all, you know, concerning labor.
What were some
labor.
Of the questions?
Just concerning labor. Do you support national right to work,
right.
which none of us do? Do you support the right to organize? Do you support,
right.
would you support a strike? So it was all kind of softball questions, right? And we also had rank and file members across around the table. And I remember a lot of other organizations were endorsing right away. And we're like, no, we can't. We don't know where our members stand. And the difference
is— Were you the only union to not endorse
The right firefighters.
Away? Okay.
Eddie Kelly, he's another Boston guy, real good guy, does a good job. They got about 300,000 members nationwide. But so what we did was we did polling. So the first polling we did was a straw poll, right, where we have 319 union halls nationwide. And you call everybody into a meeting, and you're going to get the people that support you and your local union
yeah.
into these meetings. So we figured, oh, it's going to be 80-20, you know, Biden-Harris.
Yeah.
Well, it was like 35 Biden-Harris, 30 Trump, and then, you know, others.
That's so literally the breakdown of this office.
So I went like this. I went, well, this wasn't a good gauge.
Right.
So then we have a magazine that goes out to 1.3 of our million members. So we do the straw poll, then the debate happens.
The catastrophic debate,
which, you know, say what you will. I mean, I felt bad for the guy. I really did. I mean, he should have never been put in that position. So we put out a QR code on a publication that goes to 1.3 million of our members. And we had like a record turnout of people, like 180,000 that actually responded. Because look, no one reads the mail. Right. But when we were pushing it out there on all our social media platforms, we got like 185,000 people
a lot.
To respond, which is a lot. Right. And 65% of them were voting Republican, 35% or 33 point something were voting Democrat. And I think the remaining were independent, or it might have been 65.
So you're basically representing an organization that not only is not leading for the Democrat, which most people would assume, but is seeming to lean Republican. And so you invite all of these candidates into your headquarters.
Right.
Tell me what happened when Kamala Harris showed up.
When we invited them all in, President Trump was like the first to respond. Yeah, we'll do it. Give us a date. And we had we had every one of the candidates in, and they were all characters. I mean, Cornel West, he showed up with a boxing glove for me signed because I almost got in a fight with Senator Mark Wayne Mullen. So he showed up with a boxing glove signed. I mean, just good people. Like, got to meet some good people through the process.
Totally forgot he ran. What was RFK like?
RFK was, you know, pretty passionate. And, you know, he said all the right things. It's just he wasn't going to win.
Right.
And then, but my point to all this was Trump said right away, we'll come in. Okay, schedule him. We got the majority of all the candidates in early. And, you know, the last three, which was Trump, Biden, and then Harris. Trump came in probably January of 24. And then trying to get Biden in after that, it was like dealing with his staff. You know, they were kind of offended that we would expect him to go through this
process. Oh,
yeah,
really?
They were pissed off at that, but they were like offended that we asked them that they had to come in. And so we ended up getting that done. And, you know, again.
Before he dropped out.
And then after the debate to get Harris in there, like she was like appalled that we would even ask her to come in. Like,
how did that get expressed?
I'll tell you how it got expressed. So we had a general executive board meeting probably around June of 2024. And there was an event that one of our vice presidents, Joan Corey, she's out of my local. She went to, I don't know if it was an Emily's List event the day before our general executive board, and Vice President Harris was there. And so they do a photo op line. So Joan goes in the line and Joan says, I'm Joan Corey. I'm a vice president with the Teamsters Union. And she pointed her finger at Joan and said, Teamsters better get on board. And so Joan says, excuse me? Yeah, Teamsters better get on board. I don't know why you haven't endorsed me yet. So she comes back and she tells me this. And I'm like, the nerve, right? So that happens. And then we eventually get her in before our general executive board. And again, like you said, there were 16 questions. They all had the same 16 questions. You know, Trump might have answered 9 of them or whatever. Biden only answered about 5 or 6. And then Harris's campaign or people were trying to negotiate how many she was going to answer and said, we're only going to answer 3. And it was like a 1 hour deal, 1 hour venue. And so she really didn't answer the questions. And then on the 4th question, my chief of staff slides me an index card and says, this is the last question. She's not answering anymore, because she wanted to like pontificate and give her speech of why the country's the way it is, why we should endorse her. And she did that a little bit. And then at the end, her closing was, listen, I'm going to win with you or without you. And it was like such a smug answer, like, okay. And that turned the majority of the people in that room off her, because we do what we call a hot wash. And the hot wash is important because instead of pointing out what everybody did bad, as a leader, after every critical situation or critical mission, I would start out saying, this is what I could have done better. This is what we should have did. So I did the same thing. Maybe we should have asked this question.
Postmortem.
Postmortem, right? Yeah. So after that comment, after that body language, and you know, you can tell someone's body language.
Totally.
You could smell it a mile away. And then once we announced that there was going to be no endorsement, that's when, you know, that's when all the keyboard warriors came out, and the attacks from the DSA, and, you know, my friends that were allegedly my friends that were, you know, high-ranking senators in the Democratic Party, you know, they didn't have a problem taking a check for $550,000 for, you know, the national PAC. But, you know, once I spoke at the RNC, then I was, you know, no good, you know.
So just to summarize it for people, 9 out of 10 of the biggest unions endorsed Kamala Harris.
Right.
The Teamsters, this was the first time in 30 years that they hadn't endorsed, right?
Yeah, we didn't endorse in 96.
Okay.
There's times we haven't endorsed.
But you were the first Teamsters leader to ever speak at the RNC.
Yes.
Okay.
1903, we've been in business.
How did you come to the decision to do that?
We said, look, and again, this is, we talk about basics, right? I learned in Massachusetts, working to get stuff done politically. In Massachusetts, different. You know, Republicans and Democrats are a lot different than they are around the other parts of the country. Always worked with both sides, worked with the Democrats, worked with the Republicans. And, you know, when we got down to D.C., I'm like, we've got to start establishing relationships, because it seems like everything is just, we just keep giving money to Democrats that don't do anything for us. Let's develop relationships. We started doing this well before any of this, you know, presidential election came up. We were meeting with people like Josh Hawley, Roger Marshall. We were meeting with people we normally wouldn't meet with, and still meeting with the Republicans.
But also the politics have just changed so much.
Oh, the politics are so whacked. I mean, it's just, you know, and I think this election, the result of this election, proved the priorities and the platform of the Democratic Party. And look, I'm a Democrat, you know.
Still,
yeah. And I don't know if they want me to be, but I still am. And, you know, this election should signify that something is broken in the Democratic Party. Instead of pointing fingers and blaming people, what's the solution to get working people back to where we once collaborated and worked, and we didn't dictate to our constituents? You know, I gave this speech I gave it Tuesday in Hawaii, the IATSE convention. And I explained everything we did through the election process. I explained, you know, how transparency, all this stuff. So the thing ends, and it was great. Well received, my message. I'm walking through the lobby, and this lady, you know, she comes up to me, and you know how you look at certain people and you go, okay, you know, this is a lefty. This is a lefty, right? And not because of the way she stands in the batter's box or throws the ball, but you could just tell. And she was like, there was a bunch of people I was saying hi to walking out. And she grabs me and she's like, what? Because in my speech, I said, you know, 65% of our members voted Republican. So she walks up to me and says, and I'm always respectful to people. And she says, what are you going to do to educate those 65% of your members? I says, nothing. Why? She's like, well, obviously they voted the wrong way. I go, according to who? I said, the question should be, what are those Democrats that once had organized labor, rank and file members, what should they be doing? Should they be reaching out to these members and find out what they should be doing differently? Because if I reach out to my members and try and dictate to them how they should vote when they've told me how they want to vote, isn't that counterproductive? So isn't there some responsibility from the elected officials that lost the support of working people? Well, I never thought of it that way. Oh, of course you didn't. So it's just some of that mentality.
So the big story, right, is mm-hmm. that when I was growing up, Democrats were the party of working people. Democrats were the party of labor unions. Like, that was just baked in.
It was like 10th grade geometry. Yeah, it was a given.
Exactly. So I want you to, like, pretend you are one of those 65%. Why are those people, steel man their argument for me, okay? Tell me why they're voting for Trump. Because the average Democratic senator or congressman will say, what is wrong with these people? They are voting against their economic interests, and they don't see it that way.
First and foremost, you know, our members are pretty sophisticated. They're a lot more educated. And, you know, formulating opinions, you know, to make such a vast change doesn't happen overnight. I mean, you look back and you think about this, and I say this a lot. Over the last 20 years, 16 out of those 20 years was a basically Democratic-controlled country, mm-hmm. right? And when you look back, what did working people get out of those 16 out of 20 years? You look at the Obama administration, right? We had a Democratic House, Democratic Senate, Democratic president. And our biggest platform, when I say our biggest platform for labor, was the Employee Free Choice Act. That should have been a layup. We should have got that. We didn't get that, right? Joe Biden fixed pensions. And I'm glad he did, because one of mine was fixed. But he fixed a problem that was created by the Democrats in 1980 when they passed deregulation, right? And we lost 400,000 members in the Teamsters Union, in the trucking industry, which we lost 400,000 jobs. You lost good companies that were forced into bankruptcy, which you weren't getting pension contributions on, and it kept deteriorating. Then deregulation, you know, flew through, you know, many other industries. And Ted Kennedy introduced the bill. Joe Biden signed off on it. Ronald Reagan signed off on it. So people forget why we're in that spot. So whenever someone say, oh, Joe Biden, fix your pension. He was the greatest president for union. He was a great president for union people. He fixed the pension. Yes, he did. But he broke it as well because, you know, and I say this all the time. It's like me playing street hockey in my neighborhood in 1980. I break my mother's window. 40 years later, I decide to fix it, right? Should I get accolades for a problem that I helped create?
That you created, right.
So, you know, when I talk about things like that, but, you know, the Democrats seem lately that, you know, they're not, my thing is, I always look at it from a simple perspective. You're paying me to do something, or if you're electing me to do something, I work for you, okay? Where the Democrats lost, and I think you made a good point earlier, they fell in love with their captors. They fell in love with big money. Mm. They fell in love with big tech, and they forgot who they truly were representing, working people. You know why? Because they're not in their communities, not in their neighborhoods. You know, they're not talking to the people that they're paid to represent. And when you talk to people one-on-one, look, I can sit in my office all day, every day, and try and solve problems over the phone. And I'm not going to get a true testimonial of what is actually going on. And I told you earlier, like, I'm in workplaces, my partner and I, we're in workplaces, you know, 3 days, three different states per week. And we're not talking to leaders or anybody else. What going on the shop floor is talking to rank and file members. That's where you get the best gauge. And that discipline should hold true. And I think the Democrats forgot that they need to be in their communities where they represent, talking to people, finding out and identifying the issues that truly matter. Look, this whole election for the Democrats was based on social justice issues, right? Our members, you know, the Teamsters, and I can speak for the Teamsters, we solve a lot of those social justice issues by negotiating the strongest contracts, by fighting for rights, fighting for diversity, fighting for, you know, equality in the workplace. And it seemed like this narrative of the social justice issues, it didn't identify with our members. Our members identify with more money in their pockets, more job protection, you know, better pensions.
Core issues
and a path from the start of your job into a career, into retirement. I mean, it's simple block and tackling. And that's not what our members wanted to hear.
So 65% of your members, let's say, voted Trump. You speak at the RNC. Why not go the whole way and just endorse him?
Because we still have to serve the 35% of our other members that, you know, we've got to respect their opinions as well. And yeah, I mean, I got questioned. Well, that's the majority.
Right.
Right. But the majority, you know, that's okay when you're ratifying a contract or anything else. This is like the direction of this country for the United States. And look, let's be candid. I mean, this was probably one of the most bizarre elections and unpredictable elections we're probably ever going to see in our lifetime. So if you made a choice either way, I mean, that was a pretty significant gamble. And we talked as an executive board based upon what our members said. It was in the best interest of, you know, our members that we've got to respect, you know, who's voting Republican, but we also have to respect who's voting Democrat as
well. What was the response from rank and file members to your speech?
We got a good response. I mean, you're always going to get people that are critical. I got more criticism from other labor leaders in different unions. And, you know, and it's fine. You know, some of them were my friends.
Do you guys have like a WhatsApp group where you're all talking to each other?
No, I stay off all that shit, to be honest.
But like,
with
you. Are you in pretty close communication with other labor leaders?
I was. I really was. I'll be honest with you. It just feels like right now, sometimes you're on an island by yourself. But look.
You're on an island by yourself because of politics.
Politics. But, you know, a lot of these unions, I get along with all of them. I mean, now when I see them, we're fine. But, you know, there's a different change in attitude towards us. I mean, you know, I can't believe it didn't go with Harris and Waltz. I'm like, awful candidates. You know, they didn't identify with our members. Yeah, but I go, well, do you think your members are voting anything any differently than mine?
Right. And what do they say?
Oh, we know our members. I'm like, well, maybe you do. I said, but you know, the fact is I got to worry about the people that give me the honor and privilege to serve them. And that's what we did. But to your point, look, I get along with everybody. But I've seen some of the emails that I wasn't supposed to see. I've seen some of the texts.
Like what?
Just like, I can't believe this bald-headed bastard from Boston isn't endorsing, you know, Biden or isn't endorsing Harris. And I know who they are. And it's funny when I talk to them, I'm just looking at them. I haven't called them out.
Other labor leaders.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And I'm laughing because it's
Well, one of them might be, I don't know, United Auto Workers President Sean Fain. I'm not saying.
Yeah, I'm sure. Yeah, yeah.
Well, there was sort of like this sort of tale of two Seans because I watched you.
There's only one Sean that matters.
Well, like, I guess I'm sitting across
from
him.
And that Sean spells his name correctly, by the way.
Okay, amazing. Well, you're at the RNC speaking.
Right.
In the meantime, he's at the DNC sounding a very different note. People might remember it. He called Trump a lapdog of the billionaire class. He said things like, when Donald Trump was president, corporate America ran wild. Donald Trump didn't bring back the auto industry, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. What were you seeing that he was not?
Well, see, the difference is I had conversations with President Trump. And he said, look, I want to bring industry back here. I want to bring jobs back here. I want to make sure that, you know, we put a strong immigration policy. We're not losing good American jobs. Americans aren't losing jobs to immigrants. I mean, his whole campaign was based upon the borders and the crisis of the borders, but it also entailed, you know, creating jobs. Now, yeah, Sean Fain was pretty bold, but again, I had conversations with President Trump where I knew that he wanted companies back here. He was very critical of the bad trade deals about the tariffs. A lot of the stuff was done in the early 90s as well under the Clinton administration. So, you know, I mean, look, I'm a person that if I'm going to call you out, I'm going to know exactly what I'm calling you out over. I'm going to call you out based upon a lot of qualified information that I have. You know, sometimes people run their mouths and people say things and then, you know, look, right now, I mean, I think you're going to see the auto industry coming back to the United States strong. I think you've already seen commitments to that, which is going to benefit his members. I think if you asked him right now, and again, I don't talk to Sean Fain at all, and there's no issue. It's just, I think if you asked him, you know, if you had to, you know, tone down your rhetoric a little bit, knowing what was going to be coming your way, would you have acted the same way at the DNC? And that's a question he has to answer. Me personally, if I got the opportunity to speak there, I would have gave that same exact speech.
That you gave to the RNC at the DNC?
Yeah, absolutely. I would have, because it actually was more fitting at this point in time when I was talking about corporate elitists I think there's more corporate elitists that were represented in this election in the Democratic Party than there were in the Republican Party.
Say more. What do you mean?
Well, I mean, you look at like big tech. You know, I fight against Uber, Lyft every single day, Google, all the rest of them. And Kamala Harris's brother-in-law, Tony, whatever his name is, he's like the general counsel for Uber. So where is their priority if she gets elected? What's his motive, right? Other than he's good with money, but look, he's going to be loyal to who he works for. And you can see it right now. You look in California, Governor Newsom. We put a bipartisan bill that we worked in California on regarding driverless autonomous vehicles. We had full support, a majority support, bipartisan. And we put that to his desk and he vetoes it. He vetoes the requirement of a, and why? Because he's in love with big tech and they support him and he thinks they're going to be supporting him in his probably presidential election.
Let's go through just some of the issues. Trump's been president for how many months?
6 months, 7 months.
Okay. So it just feels like a lot longer than that. Right. But let's go through some of the core issues. So immigration, mm-hmm. He's basically closed the southern border.
Right.
Now there's these, you know, deportations that are happening, in my view, sort of terrorizing a lot of people who are just here to have a good life for their children. But let's leave that part of it right. to the side. The broad story sort of told by Donald Trump, and I would say lots of people on the, let's say, pro-union, anti-immigrant, not anti-immigrant, anti-illegal immigrant, right, is that more immigrants to this country, like there's basically a set pie. And the more immigrants you have in this country, those immigrants are taking away good jobs mm-hmm. for American workers. Do you think that that's broadly a true story?
You know, there's two sides to that argument, right? It's like, so I don't think anybody, especially a parent of two children, and your parents as well, you don't want people coming into this country illegally to commit violent crimes against
women, of course not.
Women, children, or trafficking or anything else, right? Those people should not be allowed to be in this country, and if they are, they should be deported. You've got other people that have come over here the right way. My great-grandparents came over from Ireland. They went to the Catholic Church. They were shown the path to a home, a job, and naturalization. And I don't think anybody has a problem if that's the way it's going to be. I go, if anything, I think immigration now, this should be a quicker, more expedited path to citizenship if people come over with the right intentions to honor this country, cherish it, obey the laws of this country, and be a good American citizen. I don't think anybody has a problem with that.
But I want to ask you about like sort of the economic story, right? There's sort of two stories that are told, right? One story goes like this. Immigrants, illegal or, you know, right. coming here legally, they are doing the kinds of jobs, the kind of manual labor, tedious labor, backbreaking work that Americans just don't want to do. Then there's another story, which is, no, Americans do want to do those jobs. The problem is that illegal immigrants are sort of artificially suppressing wages.
Yeah,
what's the right story?
Well, I think two stories there. I think one, you're 100% right. When you have, you know, low wage earners, illegal immigrants that are working in the fields, you know, and farms and
like
and,
all of California.
Stuff like that. All of California. Yeah, you're not going to, I don't think many Americans want to do those jobs. However, there's a bigger problem that Americans would be doing those jobs somehow, or immigrants coming over, they should be paid a lot more money for those jobs they're performing, and there should be a pathway to citizenship from the employers that are exploiting them. No one's talking about the employers that employ these illegals. Nothing's happening to them, right? So that's another story that isn't being told, but you know, to your point, there are some jobs you can't get Americans to do, and that's when we should be expediting citizenship, providing them opportunities to get a entry-level job, so to speak, there, and then transition into another job, or even better, let's organize those workers, and they are organized in some areas. But I guess on the other side of that, I've heard it at the building trades where, you know, non-union employers or non-union contractors will go in and infiltrate a job with illegal immigrants, where normally if a union contract is bidding on that same job, they would get it, but where there's such a low ball and these employers are exploiting these immigrant workers, yeah, that's a problem. That's a real problem. That's a true problem. And again, forget about, you know, the deportation, forget about how it happened and people getting taken off their jobs. No one's talking about these employers in this country that have been doing this for decades upon decades upon decades. I was organizing in the produce market in Boston in the mid-2000s, and every time, and they were predominantly immigrant workers, and every time the company would get wind that we were in there organizing them, they would call ICE, mm-hmm. or they would threaten to call ICE. So it's a crazy, crazy
But is the narrative. Reason we're not talking about that is because the argument would be we all benefit from cheaper things.
And well, no. We don't benefit from cheaper labor. We would pay the same for everything as long as greedy CEOs would take less and corporate America would take less and provide more to their workers and not pass the cost on to consumers. I mean, it's a simple fix.
Okay. Donald Trump, at least in the early days of his administration, was extraordinarily aligned with Elon Musk. Obviously, have had a falling out, et cetera.
If you didn't see that one coming.
Then you're an idiot. But did that worry you at first? You've talked about being...
Yeah, so I never knew anything about Elon Musk other than he's a freak. I mean, a complete freak, right? And, you know, you can just look at him. This, you know, his motor isn't... There's something bizarre going on in that mind, you know? But I think what a signal early...
But he had been very outspoken in his opposition to organized labor.
Yeah, with the UAW, 100%, yeah, 100%. We didn't cross paths with him. Yeah, but he didn't... Listen, he's not a good guy. I mean, he's not there for working people. Did it worry me, to your question? Yeah, it worried me because... what worried me more, when you saw Vivek Ramaswamy the day of the inauguration, after working with him in a transition of 2.5 months, step away and say, no, this isn't for me. Then you knew something was going to happen. I mean, people were saying it's not going to last more than 6 months. They'll have a falling out.
But what I'm getting at is this kind of really mixed picture with this president. On the one hand, he's closing the border, ostensibly very good for labor and working people. On the other hand, putting Elon Musk to the side, you know, he's surrounded by more billionaires on stage at his inauguration than mm-hmm. any president I can remember. You know, on the one hand, he seems to care a tremendous amount about your core issues. On the other hand, you know, he is embracing big tech and lots of the transformative technology that's right. coming. So grade him for me. Like, you know, not even a year into office, how do you think he is doing on the issues that most matter to the Teamsters and organized labor?
The Teamsters union is a little bit different because the position we took during that election has given us a lot of access to this administration where we actually have the ability to have conversations. And there were some decisions made that were going to affect a lot of our members. And we were able to get to the administration and say, look, this is not what you talked about. This is not what you talked about. These are our members. We can't afford to lose these jobs. On the other hand, he's getting criticized because of, you know, smaller government. People are getting laid off. Federal unions are going after him because a lot of their members are losing their jobs.
And you have the big, beautiful bill that just passed.
Big, beautiful bill, right? And
which critics would say, like, benefit the wealthiest Americans.
Benefit the wealthiest, yeah. So, I mean, I think if you were going to grade him, like, there'd be two grades, okay? There'd be...
Yeah.
The policy and platform he said he was going to do as far as immigration, a couple of the other things, I think he's a solid B, right? For us, he's a B because, you know, we haven't had too many effects. And by the way, people forget that, you know, we were the reason why Laurie Chavez de Remer is the Secretary of Labor. We went down and lobbied hard for her because, you know, she voted for the PRO Act while she was a Republican congressperson and her father's a retired Teamster. In the field that they were going to choose from to be the Secretary of Labor were all union-busting attorneys. So, you know, I'm going to call balls and strikes. Are we thrilled with everything he's done? Absolutely not. But are we thrilled with the things we have asked for and we've gotten done? We are pretty happy.
But you said there's two grades. So right. There's the B, and what's the other grade?
Well, the grade I would say from other organized labor, I mean, you know, the building trades, you know, I know they're not happy. So, I mean, I would say if you were another union, you'd be looking at that saying he's probably a C, C minus.
So when we're just sort of looking at the complicated picture that is Donald Trump and his relationship to labor, Elon Musk is part of that picture, immigration is part of that picture, and another part of it is DOGE and some of the cuts and some of the things that DOGE has done that I think a person like you would say has been terrible for workers, like cuts to OSHA, et cetera. How did you feel about the DOGE effort, which frankly seems to have died off more recently?
Yeah, the DOGE effort at first, I mean, it was frightening because, you know, there was, you know, again, you get back to every president in probably the last, you know, 20 years has always complained about big government and, you know, we want a smaller government, but at the cost of what? Like, are we embracing cuts at OSHA, workers' safety? No, we're not going to embrace that stuff. Are we embracing, you know, the elimination of the National Labor Relations Board? No. I think what we were hopeful was going to happen and maybe some opportunity still to happen is, you know, it's like anything else. Anybody that takes over an organization, the first thing you go into is you make cuts and you look at where, you know, things aren't running efficiently. It doesn't, because cuts are made early on, doesn't tie someone's hands behind their back of rebuilding something that's been broken, like the NLRB. NLRB is a great tool for working people. I avoided the NLRB when I was organizing at Local 25 and even still—
It's the National Labor Relations Board.
We do still because it's an antiquated system that was getting criticized by organized labor and everybody else that had to utilize and employers through every administration since I've been in office at Local 25 and now. And, you know, it was took too long to make decisions, wasn't efficient enough, it was a hard process. And that is true, that is accurate. And the Trump administration, you know, cut a bunch of funding for OSHA, NLRB, and everything else. More importantly for us, those are important institutions that we are monitoring right now. There's this other thing that's more important than anything. It's called the Fair Labor Standards Contract. That is going to be the true testament. If we can get bipartisan support on that, that'll define what views the President of the United States has on organized labor. But as far as these other cuts that he made to a lot of these organizations, I mean, we're monitoring them. And look, if we think it's too deep and it's not doing right by working people, you're going to hear from us.
Let's talk about Bernie Sanders for a second, because there's—
He doesn't talk to me anymore.
Why?
I don't know.
When did he stop talking to you?
Right after I spoke at the RNC.
Did you used to talk to him a lot?
All the time. I did rallies with him around the country.
And then what happened? Just went totally silent?
Just whenever, I think he looks at it as a betrayal of not endorsing the Democratic Party. He's never said that, but his whole attitude and access has completely— completely changed towards us. You know, I mean, we called him last week, or my staff called him last week because we're working bipartisan on this bill for the Faster Labor Standards Contract, which is basically a thinner version of the PRO Act.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he's got a problem with it, and the staff was not too nice to my staff. So it's like, you know, we're only as good to people when we're carrying their water, but I guess, you know, that doesn't matter. I mean, look, I like the guy. I have respect for him. I saw him on Joe Rogan. I don't know. I mean, this is the problem with politics. People take things too personal. And when you don't go along to get along because you're actually, you know, listening to people you represent and they don't talk to you anymore, you know, that's a problem. It's fine.
Do you think if he had been the candidate instead of Hillary, we would have a very different Democratic Party? Were these trends sort of inevitable?
These trends were going to happen. These trends were going to continue on. I just think it was just started going down a different path than it should have been going down, and it just snowballed. I mean, you know, you look at right now, who's the face of the Democratic Party right now?
Zora Mamdani.
Well, that's in New York, but I'm saying on a federal level, right?
Who's the face?
I don't know. I can't identify one. And the problem is, like, I thought after the election, especially once people got over pointing fingers and blaming everybody. And I said to my mother recently, I'm like, I'm getting crushed by people saying that I should endorse Harris because she'd be the president. I'm like, I don't realize I had that much weight, like where we could make up. We only had 1.3 million members, which probably 10 or 11% of them vote. That wouldn't have moved the needle either way, but I'm glad people think that way. But I don't know who that is. I mean, you look at—
Who do you think it should be?
it's got to be someone that has, it's got to be a younger vision that has to be open to, you know, solving any and all problems, regardless of what political affiliation you are. I mean, you look at like a guy like Josh Shapiro, right? I don't know where he's going to be. I don't know where his politics are. Seems to be doing a good job in Pennsylvania. Gretchen Whitmer out of Michigan, she seems to be able to work bipartisan.
But these are, you know, forgive me, like we're a little different age, but we're both of a cohort where like those are normal Democrats.
Right.
That doesn't seem to be where the party's going.
But they're
going.
Normal Democrats that I would assume if you ask them, what was the problem the last time around? They're gonna agree with what you and I are talking about.
I agree.
Today.
I'm saying
there's still hope.
But there's who they are people who our generation would prefer. If you look at just to stay on New York, because that's where we're sitting for a second, most of the New York unions, I think almost all of them, have endorsed a socialist with many wild views that we don't need to get into in this conversation. I've covered them extensively, but they've endorsed Zora Mamdani. What does that mean?
Well, I think, again, it's just, you know, culturally, that's the direction the Democratic parties went in. And, you know, New York City is definitely, you know, dug in on that same platform. And not all unions went with Mamdani. Don't forget when Cuomo was in there, there was a lot that went with Cuomo. And then you just recently seen the cops and firemen go with Adams because of the defund the police stuff, you know?
Yeah.
So I don't know. I mean, AOC? No, absolutely not.
Why absolutely not?
Oh, because she's, you know, she's, again, another social justice warrior. You know, she's personally called me out. I've never met the woman in my life. But, you know, she just doesn't, you know, and if you look at how they voted in her district, I mean, I would spend the majority of my time in my district identifying what my people need instead of, you know, trying to put myself on the ballot for 2028.
But these are people, AOC, Mamdani, we can name a few others, who are, maybe you would say they're just cosplaying as like pro-labor politicians. Like they're saying all the things, like, we stand up for working people. That's their whole platform. Why do you say that's bullshit?
But do they though? It's bullshit because I'll tell you why. This last election, Joe Biden walked a picket line with the UAW. Awesome, he should. I've had 250 strikes in 3 years. The only politician that has walked one of my picket lines has been Josh Hawley. And recently we have a couple in Boston. You've had the whole congressional district in Massachusetts walking. Mm-hmm. But other than that, they've never been on picket lines. We were fighting Amazon where we were looking for letters of support. There's people that you just mentioned that didn't sign our letters or didn't show up, yet they want to call you out on everything that you don't agree with them on. They'll call you out saying he's not right, like AOC's in some like crazy DSA chat or something, whatever it is, saying Sean O'Brien shouldn't be allowed to represent the Teamsters Union. Why? Because I don't agree with you? Like, should you not be allowed to be in Congress because you don't agree with me? I don't agree with you? It's like, lady, I'll put up my record against yours when it comes to defending working people. I'm not out here for a press conference or a photo shoot. We're actually out there doing the work, negotiating the contracts, organizing. And, you know, right in her district, you know, I mean, we struck Amazon. I think she showed up like the last day. Chuck Schumer wouldn't even sign a letter of support.
Why are you still a Democrat?
Why?
Yeah, why aren't you an independent?
I don't know yet because I'm a loyal person, right? You know, it's like I'm still a Catholic, right? I'm still a Catholic, and the Catholic Church went through a ton of scrutiny, right? A ton of problems they brought on themselves. But it's like, look, where I grew up, you know, you're loyal, and hopefully, you know, they'll see the light. If not, we're just going to keep doing. Look, I'm a realist. That's what I am. I wish there was a party affiliation called Realist because, you know, I want to be the person that can have those conversations with anybody and agree to disagree on what we can agree on, disagree when we can't, and find a solution to problems instead of weaponizing issues that need to be solved in this country.
And Josh Hawley's doing that.
He's attempting to do it. Roger Marshall's attempting to do it. And we have great, you know, Cory Booker. I mean, he's been great with us as far as, you know, signing on to the Fair Labor Standards contracts. Ed Markey, who I disagree with a lot, you know, he's done some good stuff for us in the warehouse protection bill. And that's the problem. Like, once, and again, we were going through the confirmation process, and this is where my eyes were wide open, is confirmation process of Larry Chavez de Rima. And I was calling a lot of Democratic senators that I knew, and I'm like, hey, you got a supporter. I can't. Why not? I just can't because it's Trump pick. Well, isn't anybody that's going to be nominated?
It's inevitably going to be the choice of the president.
And then I'd have to say, like, look, I went down. I talked to her. I vouched for her. You think I would put my name on someone that... But I said, furthermore, any issue that comes up that's going to be good for labor or working people, potentially could be good for labor people, you're going to vote against because it's a Trump initiative? Like, that was the mentality. I'm like, this is wrong. This is wrong. Let's look at each and every issue individually and say, yeah, you know what? I can support this or I can't support it. And here's the reasons why. Just to say, no, it's a Trump nominee. Well, he's the president. That's the right of a president, whether you like him or you don't like him. Are we going to vote against everything?
One of the things that I've noticed about, so my only interaction with unions, aside from the fact that my brother-in-law is a firefighter in Pittsburgh and is a member of the union, did not grow up in a union household, but I did go to a fancy school where all of the graduate students were trying to unionize. Or I worked at the New York Times where, you know, growing up, it was like, you're in a union because, like, unions need to exist because these people do very dangerous work, often physical labor, and need to be protected in case of an accident or, God forbid, worse. And now all of a sudden, I'm sitting next to, like, Middle East PhD students, or PhD students in the history of the Middle East, or, you know, in Midtown Manhattan with, you know, opinion writers at the New York Times claiming they need their labor rights and their union rights. My perception of what unions are, I just think, is wildly different based on the kinds of people that I've seen unionized or trying to unionize, who I feel are almost like pretending to be labor, if that makes sense. And I'd love for you to talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, I think, I mean, look, your traditional, if you took a traditional snapshot of a union member, and again, not to be, you'd think of rugged men and women.
I think about you. Doing rugged, you're like my caricature of who a union guy is.
But we've evolved. Labor's evolved, right? Where, you know, it wasn't just about blue-collar people fighting for their rights and the rights to organize and collectively bargain. Those same attacks happen in white-collar arenas as well. So I think that's a testament to what organized labor has done, the history as far as representing working people. Now you get to this other academia, so to speak.
But I feel that it's stolen valor. It's like...
It's. I wouldn't say...
Do you not feel that way?
Sometimes when I hear the rhetoric of... Like, I spoke at an event in New York. I think it was New York University, whatever. And we just finished the UPS agreement. And we finished that deal, which they control 7% of commerce. If I had an ego and I wanted to, like, you know, stroke my ego, I could have easily struck that company and said, I struck UPS. But we negotiated the deal, and we negotiated the best deal without a strike. The threat of a strike was the thing that got the deal done. And I'm speaking at this event on a panel, and there's a woman that wrote books. She's a UAW member, and she's completely academia, and she's getting up there. We need a strike. We need a strike. Everybody needs a strike. And I'm like, no, you don't need a strike. I mean, strikes are great, but if you can avoid them and keep your members working and get the best deal for them without it, Why go through? We just need a strike. Well, answer me. Tell me why. Like, debate me why. And we started going back. Debate me why. That's why I'm not an academic. But I said, well, tell me why. Like, I'll have this debate with you, right?
Debate me, bro.
Yeah. And she's like, well, you just don't understand. No, I understand. I've been on a million picket lines. I'm the guy that showed up at his wedding 3 days before with 8 stitches, black eye, and a broken hand. I said, so don't tell me about what goes on picket lines. To your point, I think it's true of anything. Like, people have a certain opinion and or creativity when they think they're, you know, involved in a union. Until it actually, like, I love the saying, like, everybody wants to do big boy shit until it comes down to doing big boy shit and the whole opinion changes. I don't know if the
But there's a strange incentive, right? Because, like, as traditional union membership has declined,
yeah,
there's an incentive for organized labor to say, all right, we're going to organize graduate students. We're
No, I think there's valid issues, though. And you're right to a certain extent, but I think there's valid issues. Like when you see these universities and these endowments that billions upon billions of dollars, and they're trying to nickel and dime adjunct professors or anybody for that matter. Like, of course, you want to join a union, you want to collectively bargain, you want to get the best contract, but you want to have, you know, stability. So I think genuinely, you know, academia has seen the fruits of what other unions have done or the values of being in a union. And I think, you know, they have taken it to another level. I think a lot of them are still, you know, a lot of the academia that I dealt with, they're still aligned with the far left.
I think maybe one of the most damaging things to the reputation of unions writ large happened during COVID, where a lot of these teachers' unions were basically not thinking about the children who were suffering from lockdowns and having to share an iPad with four siblings and fell behind in learning to an extent that is still shocking. And the unions were fighting even deep into COVID for schools to remain closed, for them to not come into school. And beyond that, I think parents all of a sudden were having to come face to face with the poor quality of a lot of these teachers. What did you feel about that personally?
Well, personally, it's funny. I just had a conversation with Vivek Ramaswamy last week. I had him on my podcast. And again, a billionaire, right? And said all the right things about unions. But he did highlight, but I don't like the teachers union. And I'm like, why don't you not like the teachers union? Don't you think they should have a right to collectively bargain? I'm not saying they don't, but let's talk about COVID. I go, okay, let's talk about COVID. He said, you know, I went to a Catholic school. And the Catholic school stayed open through COVID. I go, the Catholic schools are a business. Let's be realistic. He said, well, you know, there's a lot of teachers. I don't like how they operate. I don't like, you know, the structure of the teachers. I don't like the fact of what they did during COVID. And I said, look, anybody can have a debate about what happened during COVID because I think it was probably the most uncertain times we ever had. My own personal opinion, I love the teachers union. I love public schools. I went to public schools my whole life. Some of the most influential people in my life are public school teachers. And you think about it, different times, right? They had us for 8 hours a day, captive audience. A lot of them were our coaches. So I had a different relationship with them. But to your point about as far as COVID goes right now, I think it could have been handled a lot differently. You know, I think initially, you know, the teachers, just like everybody else, were so uncertain about the health and safety. They didn't want to put themselves at risk. They didn't want to put the children at risk. I think COVID was the worst thing that could have happened to this country. And I think it was, you know, something that should have been dealt with a lot differently as far as schools go. And I think if you ask the majority of the people, even teachers, they would probably agree right now. Again, but it happened. It's over, right? And people still want to go back and say, well, the teachers did this during COVID. Okay. But what about prior to COVID when they were working hard, you know, all the good things they did for generations upon generations? Why aren't we talking about that? Why are we going back to talk to COVID? And my point to Vivek on this whole thing was, I said, look, if there's an issue, instead of throwing bombs at each other, get in a room and say, here's my issue with teachers during COVID. And do you think we could have did something different? Do you think we could have got people back to school? But you got to blame the whole temperature of the country at that time. Like I even said, I was so pro-vaccination because I had a personal issue that happened to me where I ended up in a coma in January 2020 and I got my last rites, right?
What?
Yeah. I had a scar that had to get fixed under my eye and I got a needle and I got a viral infection, which a month later I ended up, I'm on life support with a ventilator, right? You know, January of 2020. So when I came out of that, I came out angry saying, I can't believe this stuff. I'm a pretty good person. I live clean. Why me? Like, I want to live a long time. I got two boys. And then when COVID hits, I'm like, I'll take any vaccination to live.
I felt that way,
right?
Too. Yeah.
But I saw some residual things that happened over the years. I saw the way the government handled COVID. I saw the kind of the narrative that probably wasn't as true as we thought it was at the time. And, you know, the teachers probably looked at it the same way. But my point to all this is, you know, you can only solve problems if you have conversations. And look, I've done things.
But with everyone, I guess, except Jeff Bezos.
Yeah, I'd love to have a conversation with him.
Okay. Let's talk a little bit about some of these big tech companies that you've mentioned in this conversation.
I hate them all.
Okay. Well, there have been few unionization efforts that have gotten more attention, perhaps other than Starbucks, than Amazon. And those efforts have mostly failed, except for, I think, Staten Island being like a major exception.
They haven't failed because Staten Island was done under the ALU. That was the only one that was actually organized.
Mm-hmm.
And if you have been following it, like most of us, we are invoking a whole different strategy where, you know, we're going after the DSP model, which is their subcontracting model, and going after the warehouse. We haven't had an election since we have been involved.
Let's use Amazon as a way in because you hate a lot of these companies, but like you really hate Amazon.
I despise them.
And I want you to explain why.
Well, I mean, Amazon is, you know, what I call a white collar crime syndicate, right? Think about anybody that commits crime. In major cities, where do they focus? They focus on distressed communities. Why? Because those are the most vulnerable people. So if you see where Amazon's building or have been building and will continue to build all their warehouses and distribution facilities, the majority of them are in distressed communities where they can, you know, they focus on the immigrant workforce where there's 150% turnover ratio. And that's in the warehouse.
Explain what that means, 150% turnover ratio.
Everybody that goes in there is 50%. Turnover. So you go into some companies like UPS, there's probably a 10 or 12% turnover ratio per year, which is the equivalent size of Amazon. You go into Amazon where the working conditions are so bad, the pay is so low, and the respect is just none exists. These folks go in and there's 150% turnover every year. Amazon has the most amount of fines under OSHA, which means they don't care about their workers, they don't care about the safety of their workers, and they just pay the fines. And, you know, it's an awful place to work. I mean, when you have this day and age when people are threatened that if you go to the bathroom during a shift, you're going to be fired. It's just an awful company. And when you look at another company like UPS, which we are fighting with right now over different issues, but they're working under a collective bargaining agreement, the direct employees that are part-timers, they get health and welfare, full medical, they get pension benefits, but they get a career path to a full-time job. Amazon, once you're in the warehouse, you're not going anywhere unless you go work for a subcontractor of Amazon who pays you about $18 per hour with no benefits, no regulations, and no career path to retirement. That's a problem.
How do you personally protest? Do you not order things from Amazon? Do you not use Amazon?
It's hard not to. I mean, it's hard not to use Amazon. I try to avoid Amazon at all costs. There was a time when online shopping first came out where you got an option when you ordered something online. You could ship a UPS, FedEx, DHL, and it was always going to be UPS because they're unionized or DHL. That option isn't there now. I mean, people, there's no loyalty anymore. It's just, you know, Amazon controls everything and, you know, everybody says, I mean, look, there's certain things you have to order off Amazon. But the good news is that we've organized about 12,000 DSPs throughout the country. We struck 22 locations in December. We are building momentum to organize them. So, you know, I don't feel as guilty when I hit send and I have to get something and it's from Amazon because two things. Gives me an opportunity to talk to that person that's delivering my package and I can tell them what it is to be in a union. I can tell them, you know, how important it is to, you know, fight for your rights to organize. So
why have they not, or why has, well, why have organizing efforts not been successful at Amazon?
Well, I think for two reasons. There's such a, they have such a program. They spend about $500 million a year on union busting. That's awful. And they have a captive audience of those employees that are inside every single day. And they're talking about what's going to happen to them if they organize. Retribution, retaliation, all this stuff, which we are fighting that on state levels to make it illegal to have those meetings. We've been very successful in states. I think we've gotten success with the DSP model. And when we took over this task, we knew it was going to be a 5 to 7 year plan to organize Amazon nationwide. We've gotten some good decisions in California from the general counsel, acting general counsel of the National Labor Relations Board. So I think there is going to be a path to victory at some point in time. It's just going to be a fight.
If Jeff Bezos were sitting here, what would you say to him?
Oh, I'd call him a piece of shit.
Have you ever met him?
Never met him. Never met him. I mean, think about what he spent on his wedding. And if you just paid, if you bargain a union contract, a union contract would probably cost less than his wedding did in certain areas.
Zora Mamdani says things like billionaires shouldn't exist. Do you agree with that?
Look, I if someone's done well and worked hard and they've done well in their life, I mean, hats off to them. But if greedy billionaires that want to take on and attack working people, then no, they shouldn't. They shouldn't be allowed to be billionaires. They shouldn't have that privilege. I don't count other people's money. What I do is I focus on what the problem is, mm-hmm. and I focus on, you know, how we find a solution. And I don't care if Jeff Bezos is worth, you know, $500 billion or $500,000. You know, the same person is going to exist. He's a piece of shit. And, you know, you don't fault anybody for working hard and making money. But should billionaires, what do? Ban billionaires or just not allowed to make money? How do you regulate that?
Well, that's why I'm asking you.
I don't know.
I have
a lot of members.
But I think if
I have a lot of members that are millionaires. Like, they've worked 40, 50 years, saved their money, made investments, bought houses, worked hard,
gonna
have pensions. It's great, right?
I think if the people that run Amazon were sitting here, they would say, how could you say that this person's a piece of shit? Look at this unbelievable company that he's built. Look at all of the people they employ. And look at the way that it has, the consumer, allowed us to order things at just an amazing prices. What would you say to that?
You go into any of these facilities in New York, Boston, major cities, and you look at how these people are treated all around the country. You look at the value that, you know, they bring to that company, and you look at how they're treated, and you wouldn't treat your worst enemy the way that some of these people are treated. And, you know, the other thing too, it's like, it should resonate when people are working there for this billionaire and they are on subsidized housing. Some of them are homeless. Some of these people are homeless in major cities, going to Amazon or they're going to live in shelters. If you're that much of a high profile billionaire success story, then you should be rewarding the people that are making your company the success that it is. And that's why I say he's a piece of shit. He's not doing that.
One of the things I'm struck by in thinking about conditions, let's just say in shipping facilities or packaging systems at a place like Amazon, is that the people that are doing that labor right now could be made irrelevant by AI and robotics, let's just say the next few years. What are you going to do about that?
Well, there's a lot of opportunity to retrain people too. Like in the UPS agreement, that was on our radar screen these last negotiations. And you know, everybody will say it's not going to be here for 10 years. You and I both know that. You know, everybody wants, especially employers, they want efficiencies and they want technologies and they want to do it at the least amount of cost. But like under a unionized contract at UPS and many other industries, grocery warehouse that we represent, we negotiate and we collaborate to, you know, mandate that collaboration has to happen when implementation of technology comes into play, where we create jobs as a result of this technology. So if you're going to completely automate a facility, a shipping facility, someone's got to be repairing these shipping facilities. Someone's got to be programming these computers. You know, there's always opportunity to create new jobs. And that's what our focus has been. And that's what people should be focused on. Even these big companies, these big tech companies. I mean, what are you going to do? And I said this to the governor of Colorado recently because he vetoed
it's a Jared Polis.
Yeah. Another brain surgeon. But, the conversation I had with him was frightening, to be honest with you, because.
Why?
Well, he vetoed the bill. Before he vetoed the bill of requiring human operators in commercial vehicles, I said, my conversation started with, I love the Teamsters Union. I work hard with the Teamsters Union. I'm like, okay, great. I support the Teamsters Union. Great. I need you to sign that, you know, I need you to sign that bill. I can't do that this time. Why not? I just can't. I go, so what are we going to do with those 250,000 commercial drivers in the state of Colorado that depend upon being in a commercial vehicle, providing goods and services to this country? Where are we going to put them? I wouldn't worry about that, Sean. That's not happening for 10 to 15 years from now. But there's 10, 15 years from now, there might be 300,000 people that depend upon those jobs to make a living. Where do we put them? Where do they go to work? I haven't thought about it. I go, and put that to the side. All this infrastructure money that we're replacing roads and bridges. I said, you're going to allow these vehicles not operated by a human that are going to be heavier, destroying roads and bridges, further causing public safety issues, and a family of four goes down and gets killed by this car. Like, are you going to feel guilty? Are you going to feel bad about that? Well, it's not 10 to 15 years. I'm like, no, you don't get it. Where are you going to put these people to work? And, you know, I don't think people are thinking this stuff out. They're like infatuated with technology, and they don't realize those 250,000 people are the constituents that elected him to represent him.
I mean, just if we just go to like 30,000 feet, the kinds of radical changes, not just to jobs, but to like what it means to be a human being when a machine is smarter than you, is just so profound. It's going to be arguably more transformative to our society and to the world than the advent of electricity.
But don't you think the best computer in the world is a human brain, an instinct? Like, think about this. You're driving down the road, you drive a car or whatever.
I'm a terrible driver, but
right,
yes.
But, you know, but you have instincts. You make decisions instantly because you're not programmed just to go from point A to point B. You're programmed as a human being to look and see different potential shortcomings coming your way. These robots aren't programmed that way. They got a specific task. They're going to go from point A to point B. And look, we've seen it. You've seen it with Teslas in Arizona or Waymo. I think it's Waymo. Maybe not Tesla, Waymo, where they're running into each other. They've killed someone. I mean, the technology is not foolproof.
Of course it's not foolproof, but it's very, very good. And it's already transforming everything.
What's it good for?
Well, it's good for efficiency. It's good. Waymo, I'm sure if they were sitting here, would say, sure, there's accidents, but there's far fewer accidents with self-driving cars than there are with human beings behind the wheel. We don't need to litigate that.
Right.
The question I'm trying to get to with you is the dignity of work. What having a job in the world gives people in terms of a sense of meaning, that is all going to be up for discussion over
it's
the next
be up for grabs.
Exactly. So yeah. what's your philosophy?
Look, I think
that?
My philosophy
because
is
because some people's response is we need UBI, right? That's how we're going to solve the problem. I think that that's ridiculous. I just don't think that that solves the question of meaning and purpose in people's lives.
Right.
So what is the solution going to be? Because this technology is coming. It's
well,
here.
Yeah, the solution is to mandate, like, I mean, you look at the Big Beautiful Bill when they wanted to not allow states to regulate AI for 10 years. That moratorium that was put in there, and thankfully that got out of the Big Beautiful Bill or Big Bad Bill, whatever it's called. But what should be done? I mean, we've got to take a look at where technology, I don't think people get this perception that, oh, everybody, you know, unions want to slow down the implementation of technology, all this stuff. I don't think anybody wants to slow it down because to your point, it's already here. We've got to look for opportunities on where we can create jobs for human beings that once perform these jobs that may be performed by robots or machinery, or whatever the case may be. And there is a great opportunity to do that.
Are you ready for a lightning round?
Love it.
Okay. One word to describe the following people. Donald Trump. One word.
Chaos.
J.D. Vance.
Hard charger.
AOC.
AOC. Great bartender.
Elizabeth Warren.
It's a reason why we have pensions. Now it's one word.
It's okay.
Pension.
It's good. Bernie Sanders.
He liked him. He doesn't like me anymore.
Josh Hawley.
Solid.
Cable news channel of choice. If you're in a hotel, you got to find out what's going on. What are you going to turn on?
I'm going to turn on your podcast to see what to see what you talked about.
Yeah, right. Okay, you've settled your beef with Senator Mullen of Oklahoma, with whom you almost had this amazing physical confrontation.
Twice.
Could you kick his ass?
He's a farm boy. You know, we fight different in the city, you know? depends where we're at, you know? Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't fight him fair, so probably.
Who's the worst CEO in America?
Jeff Bezos. Well, he's not a CEO anymore, is he? Probably Jaffe or whatever his name is.
Who's the best?
The best CEO?
The best.
The CEO of my household, my girlfriend, Christine.
Which is America's sport, baseball or football?
Football.
Why?
Because it's a full contact sport, just like life.
Best player of all time?
Tom Brady.
What's the best sandwich in America? You've probably had a lot of sandwiches.
best sandwich in America, yeah. it would be a. I got to go to my neighborhood.
Okay.
Bob's Jumbo Chicken Cutlet Palm on Braided Roll.
Wow.
Went deep on that one, huh?
How often do you have that?
Not often anymore.
How many hours do you sleep a night?
I try and sleep probably, I probably get 4 to 5 hours a night.
If I polled rank and file Teamsters members and asked them, describe Sean O'Brien, how would they describe you?
Wouldn't be good looking. they might say he works tirelessly and he calls balls and strikes, and you know where you stand with him, whether you agree with him or you don't agree with him.
If you could choose anyone to run for president in 2028, who would you choose?
Who would I choose to run for president in 2028? That's a good question. Outside of the current field?
Yes. Who would be your pick? You can anoint them.
Snoop Dogg.
Why?
Because you don't want to be a nice shock value for this country, wouldn't it?
As if we need more shock after Donald Trump.
It definitely legalized marijuana nationwide.
Would you ever run for office?
No, I would never.
Why not?
No, it's not my thing. Like, I'm not a politician. Even though people think I'm a politician or people will label you a politician, I'm a working class guy from a neighborhood, you know what I mean? And I just got a lucky break and took advantage of it and worked hard to get where I am. I'm not going to sit in there and... I'd rather be influential in politics than be in politics.
If you could go back and give a piece of advice to you at 17, 18, when you became a rigger, what would it be?
Embrace different opinions, embrace different perspectives, and also, more importantly, don't look at criticism as anything but an opportunity to learn other people's perspectives.
Sean O'Brien, thank you so much.
Thank you.